Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to talk to about intelligence, about the war for the free world, than the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee? His name is Congressman Pete Hoekstra, now retired from public service, but engaged in a very important new public service, I think, and that is as the chairman of the Center for Security Policy's Advisory Board, which he has just stood up with a terrific cast of former members of Congress and other policy practitioners to help, well, advise the work of the Center for Security Policy, and we couldn't be more pleased to have him playing that role. Congressman, it's good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio, sir. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Frank. It's always good to be with you.
You have been following over the years of your time in Congress and since you've left, of course, the rise and growing danger posed to our country by the Chinese Communist Party. We'll be marking the 100th anniversary of its founding tomorrow. A dark day in human history, that's for sure. And perhaps it has helped impel actions that have been, well, underway for some time in the Congress, both in the House and the Senate, where we've seen in recent days very strong bipartisan support, I think in the Senate, unanimous support, in fact, for legislation to invest massively in various technologies that would enable us to compete more effectively against the Chinese, particularly with their so-called civil-military fusion doctrine, which takes lots of high technologies and applies them to the threat to this country, both commercial and military. Your thoughts about this legislation, Congressman? I don't mean to get into the details of it, but are we on the right track? Is this necessary? And do you think that it will make a difference if it becomes enacted?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I'm thrilled that Congress in a bipartisan way is recognizing the threat from China. For a long time, there were divisions and people not recognizing the economic, military, or, the political threat that was coming from China. But it appears that there's now bipartisan consensus. So that's a positive thing. The negative thing is, we're almost employing, communist party policy to address the challenge from China, rather than unleashing America's strength, which would be, cutting taxes, reducing regulations, and those types of things, to let the free market, leap to the forefront and once again show the power of the American economy. What we're putting in place is massive spending by the government to pick winners and losers. So the good news is we're recognizing the threat from China. The bad news is we're employing some of their policy direction to say, hey, we can invest more into our business to make them competitive than what China can. From my standpoint, kind of the wrong approach to addressing. We'll never spend more than China. We'll never cheat as much as China and those kinds of things. So let's be careful about what policies we employ. But hopefully, as we continue to be unified in approach, we will come up with better and more creative and more effective solutions to confront the challenge from China.
This is a really important point. If we simply replicate what they're doing, are we likely to be as competitive as we could be if we really, as you say, use our strengths, namely the free market system? But that brings me to a concern that's been expressed by one of your successors, namely Devin Nunes, the former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, now its ranking Republican member. He and his Republican colleagues on the committee have, as you know, Congressman Hoekstra, put together a report. Well, I guess it's a work in progress, but they've released some of the preliminary findings of an investigation that's now underway into the degree to which that very capitalist system is actually aiding and abetting the enemy. Can you talk a little bit about that problem and how serious a threat it represents to not only our future competitiveness, but to the country itself?
Sure. I mean, you know, Frank, as you know, I'm from the state of Michigan, the state where we proudly, you know, was the home of General Motors. And the statement that, you know, was very prevalent in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, hey, what's good for GM is good for America. GM was an American company. GM was, you know, we were confident that what GM was doing was good for GM, but was also good for America. We're not in the same position anymore. I think it was, you know, about 10 days ago, I think that the CEO of Nike came out and said, you know, we're a Chinese brand. We're a, you know, we're a almost saying we're a Chinese company or we are a global company. And so what you're finding is that whether it's Nike, whether it's Apple, whether it's some of our other tech companies, we have to recognize that they are global companies. They're making decisions for their business that reflect the fact that they're global companies. And they're not necessarily acting in the best interest of the United States anymore, and we should never assume that. They are acting in the best interest of their shareholders and their companies. So we've seen numerous instances where, especially again in the tech companies, they have compromised their values to do business in China. And that gets to be a real problem. And, you know, so yes, they are, you know, they use China for what China can benefit them. And China benefits them perhaps mostly by being a huge market. So they will bow to demands by the Chinese government just to have access into China, which means they may, you know, change their operating procedures. They may not be as protective of their intellectual property. They may share data and information with the Chinese government, all for the point of having access to the Chinese consumer. I saw this, you see this with American companies. I saw the same thing with European companies when I served as the ambassador to the Netherlands recently. You know, companies and governments in Europe are, it's amazing what they will do just to get access to the Chinese market.
And the question that I guess hard experience teaches us should be asked is, how long will you have that access? And at what price? And as you say, it can be a pretty steep price. You may lose your company in the end, not just your technology. But in point of fact, it may prove certainly over time that Chinese competitors will be filling that Chinese market need, not these American concerns. In a way, I'm most worried, Congressman Hoekstra, and I should say, in addition to that title, you, of course, also have the title of ambassador, having served our country as our representative in the Netherlands with distinction during the Trump years. But I default back to your former title by reflex, I guess. This practice of Wall Street in particular, putting American pensioners' monies, many of them without their knowledge, into companies that are engaged in, well, in some cases, the work of the People's Liberation Army to threaten our people is unconscionable. And it seems to me this is one of the things that Congressman Nunes and his team really have to get thoroughly exposed and countered, I hope, as a result of their analysis. Your thoughts, sir?
That's exactly right. You know, because what we do know, and, you know, some of the very companies that they are putting in money into, that they are investing, that they are funding, these companies are in a race to steal American technology, to steal intellectual property, to strengthen their own companies. And, you know, it was interesting when I, again, served in Europe, talking to different European companies who said, you know, we went into China, we established our factories, and they were successful. But the Chinese were most successful and were more successful than us because you know, within a couple of years of us being there, they were building, buildings next to our building, which were almost identical to ours. And then they started putting in equipment, which was almost identical to ours. And, you know, 10, 15 years later, we were out of business.
Yeah, they were producing things that were identical to whatever they were producing.
Right.
But the fun, the underwriting of some of this is also coming out of America. I mean, it's just, it's like the Borg, is how it's been described. Very successfully, you know, taking us apart piece by piece. Hey, before we run out of time, former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Pete Hoekstra, I want to ask you about these rumors that there is a very high level, maybe even more than one, defector from the Chinese Ministry of State Security, their intelligence services, who would be in a position to reveal an enormous amount about what the Chinese are up to, what they've done to penetrate and subvert our country, perhaps among other things in the ways we've just been discussing, but also in terms of our intelligence services, our government more generally. There's a name that's been associated with the most prominent of these, I guess, by Dong Jingwei. What's your current reading on whether this former top counterintelligence operative of China is actually now in the United States and working with the Defense Intelligence Agency?
There's a few points to think about here. I spent the last 3 days in Washington, and I've talked to a lot of my friends in the intel community and different parts of the Washington establishment, and there's kind of a divided opinion on this. There are some that are saying, yeah, Pete, this was a false rumor. It's not true. There are others that are saying, if you watch the actions of the Biden administration, authorizing this new look at where COVID came from and those types of things, there's something that's, causing the Biden administration to, change its position and make some of these decisions, which lead them to speculate that there is a defector. The other point that I would bring up is, if there is one, for once, the intelligence community has done a phenomenal job in keeping a secret. Usually they would not have been able to do this. But I think one final point, it would be it's very telling that if there is one, that he's actually engaged with the Defense Intelligence Agency, which would tell us that he knows or he believes that the CIA was not the right place to go, which is where this kind of person normally would have gone. And he wouldn't have gone there because he believes the CIA is, penetrated by the Chinese government. And that's why he didn't go there. But again, just a lot of that is speculation. I would guess we'd have to know within the next couple of weeks whether this is a true story or not.
Well, stay tuned, as they say, folks. We'll be following it closely, and I hope with your good help, Congressman Hoekstra. Let me ask you lastly, if I could. There is a very public fight underway now between Fox News host Tucker Carlson and the National Security Agency, one of our most sensitive signals intelligence operations, as you know. What do you make of the allegations that Tucker has now advanced several evenings running on his program that the NSA, as it's known, has gotten its hands on his personal emails and telecommunications and apparently had in mind using them against him in some kind of, political warfare?
Well, you and I have talked about this before, the politicization of the intelligence community. We saw this at the end of the Obama administration, the beginning of the Trump administration. It happened. The NSA, behaved in ways that were not appropriate. At the end of the Trump administration, the beginning of the Biden administration, we've seen people in the intelligence community say that, we maybe need to use the intelligence community to target the threats internal of the United States. The DNI, hinted at that with her testimony in front of the House Intelligence Committee. So number one, is it Is the claim by Tucker plausible and believable? Absolutely. Should we all be concerned about this? And the answer is absolutely yes. The intelligence community has no authority and shouldn't come near an American, within 100 miles. Their job is overseas intelligence gathering against external threats to the United States. Americans are protected by the law. We're protected by the courts. If Tucker's story is proves to be accurate, which I said, it's plausible, but if it proves to be accurate, it outlines a serious breakdown within our intelligence community.
One other concern, sir, is the possibility that the House and Senate intelligence committees, which were established for the purposes of overseeing and rooting out such misconduct by the intelligence agencies, that has now fallen down on the job as well. Any quick comment on that?
They become totally ineffective in being the watchdogs that they are supposed to be. In some cases, they're actually cheerleading for the intelligence community to do these kinds of activities to target conservatives. And as I think John Brennan or someone said, we even have libertarians here that need to be watched. They become cheerleaders for this rather than holding them accountable. I know that Devin Nunes has sent numerous letters and inquiries over to the intelligence community about these kinds of issues. And it's amazing. They believe that they don't have to respond. So months after he sent these inquiries trying to figure out what's going on, they don't even respond to him anymore. These agencies are running amok.
This is really of great concern. Congressman Pete Hoekstra, we appreciate your addressing them with us, and we look forward to further conversations with you, both about the gravity of these problems, but also what we can do about them. Thank you for your time today, sir. Come back to us again very soon, and most especially thank
sure
you
will.
For your new leadership.
Thank you, Frank.
At the Center for Security Policy's Advisory Board. We're delighted to have you there. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang is up next. We'll talk with him a bit more about the China side of all of this right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The House of Representatives on Monday joined the U.S. Senate in authorizing enormous investments to restore this country's competitiveness vis-a-vis the increasingly high technology threats posed by the Chinese Communist Party and its so-called civil-military fusion strategy. It's about time. We can't compete effectively, however, if members of our team are playing for the other side. Shortly before the House vote, Representative Devin Nunes disclosed some early, chilling findings of an ongoing investigation, including that, quote, corporate America is a target of China's malign influence campaign, and unfortunately, we're finding that some U.S. corporations are willing participants. Beijing's influence on corporate America and China's overall role in the U.S. supply chain are significant national security threats, unquote. Investing gigabillions of dollars to enhance American competitiveness won't succeed unless and until Wall Street and other U.S. businesses stop aiding and abetting the enemy. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to one of our favorite guests here at Secure Freedom Radio. He graces us each week. I'm very grateful for that, as well as privileged to be able to share him with you. His name is Gordon Chang. He is, of course, one of our country's preeminent experts on China and what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing for the past 100 years to brutalize the people of that nation and to threaten increasingly the rest of us. He is the author of numerous books, very relevant, very insightful, including The Coming Collapse of China and The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also a man who you can follow, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. It's always a delight to be able to say again, thank you for joining us, Gordon Chang.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. And it's a real privilege for me to be on your show. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Well, it's a high point of our week, as I'm fond of saying, and I'm delighted that it's part of yours. Let me just ask you to reflect, if you would, Gordon, on what the 100 years that will be massively celebrated, usually with a lot of appeals to rabid nationalism and militarism in places like Beijing tomorrow. But I think are probably years that have been mourned by an awful lot of Chinese and certainly the rest of us. But your thoughts?
Well, the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party is a day of mourning for the world, largely because we have not only China becoming the greatest threat to the United States, but also to humanity and civilization. And of course, the biggest victims of the party so far have been the Chinese people. Somewhere between 30 to 70 million people have died unnecessarily at the hands of communist rulers. So it is something that we cannot forget, that this 100th anniversary is a day that we should renew our commitment to freedom, democracy, liberty, and ending the rule of the Communist Party.
Amen to all of that. And I want to talk with you a little bit about how we might go about doing that. But before we do, just a further word about what does seem to be the rising nationalism of China at this moment. There are some who are gloating about the crushing of freedom in Hong Kong, for example. There are these wolf warrior diplomats that have been deployed around the world to boast about China's rising power and increasing capacity to threaten the rest of us. One of those is Choi Chen-kai. He is actually going home to Beijing after 8 years as the ambassador here. What did you make of his departure, and what should we expect in his replacement?
Well, he should have been sent back to China by the United States. He was involved in a number of activities that were inconsistent with his status as a diplomat. So, for instance, he helped recruit spies among American scientists, especially one in Connecticut. And so he should have been returned. Clearly, the U.S. has yet to understand fully the challenge that China poses. So to me, it seems that we have yet to get to the point where we need to be.
Again, I concur, Gordon. Let me ask you, a woman who has come out of a CCP university and issued a very strong warning along very much those lines is a guy by the name of Kai Jia. Talk a little bit about this former professor and her memorandum essentially warning that we have ignored at our extreme peril the unbridled hostility of the CCP to this country and to freedom more generally.
She had, I think the most important message she has is that the Chinese regime has viewed the United States with hostility, whereas we've had a half century of presidents who have tried to engage China to bring it into the international system, to make it a friend. She points out that the regime views us as its enemy. And you know, to a certain extent, Frank, this is willful blindness on our part. Because the People's Daily, as we pointed out before on your show, in May 2019, declared a quote-unquote people's war on us. And as Miles Yu of the Naval Academy, who worked for Secretary Pompeo, has pointed out, this hostility is inherent in China's regime because Chinese leaders fear the inspirational impact of the United States on the Chinese people. So unless we adopt a totalitarian system in the United States, we will be the enemy of the Chinese regime just by the mere fact of our existence as a democracy, as a beacon for freedom and liberty, makes us a existential threat in the minds of the Communist Party. And that means that the party is an existential threat to us, because we have to understand the way that they view the United States, and we have not done that.
I think it has to be said that even if we were a totalitarian power, unless we were submissive to the Chinese, we would still probably be regarded as their enemy. So we shouldn't. Their efforts to make us into a totalitarian system, I think, is one of the things that's deeply worrying. And Kai's warnings entitled "An Insider's Perspective" are ones that I think really have to be heeded. We've had, as I mentioned, with Pete Hoekstra earlier in the program, Gordon, a warning from Congressman Devin Nunes about the degree to which, as you say, we have seen particularly corporations in a country, in our country, and Wall Street financiers very much willfully blind, looking the other way at best, enabling for sure the Chinese Communist Party and its ambitions by enriching the party and enabling its designs. What do you make of the report? It's still, I guess, an investigation underway, but the early findings of this Republican membership of the House Intelligence Committee and their drill down on the sort of character of the contest we find ourselves in, and the fact that a lot of people nominally on our side are playing for the other team.
Well, business is business, Frank. And so there's a couple of issues here. On a minor issue, I think that American business does not understand that it does not have a long-term future in China because Xi Jinping believes that the Chinese economy should be reserved for state enterprises. But that's a really minor issue. The bigger issue is that business is, by definition, amoral. And it's up not to business leaders to determine what American foreign policy is and to implement it. It's up for our political leadership to do that, to make it illegal, for instance, to engage in some of the activities that business does. You know, I personally believe that we should not have commercial and investment relations with China. But this is a political decision. And so the failure is political. And therefore, I think that we should focus on the failure of presidents and congresses to prohibit the activity that we all find disgusting. It's a political issue, not a business one.
Yeah. You've elucidated, as you always do brilliantly, but also very compellingly, I think, at the Gatestone Institute, your case for us to stop trading with China. But, you know, to your point about the lack of political leadership, the Biden administration last week, as you know, Gordon, identified five companies, large companies, all in the solar power business, which is, of course, something that China has set its sights on dominating and largely has, that are engaged in the use of slave labor to produce these solar panels and other relevant equipment. Three of those companies are traded in one form or another on U.S. capital markets. We are, in short, being told by the Biden administration that we mustn't continue to deal with these folks. They've been put on what's called the Commerce Department's entity list. And yet, these three in particular, American investors are fully free to continue to actually help underwrite their slave labor and other, well, mercantilistic and, I believe, ultimately quite insidious operations. That, again, is a failure of leadership, and I think it has to be addressed quite quickly. Let me turn to one other piece of this that I talked about also with Pete Hoekstra, Gordon, and that is the awakening that seems to be taking place, I think, in no small measure thanks to your efforts over the years, in the Congress of the United States on a bipartisan basis, that we must take steps to compete much more fulsomely with the Chinese, in terms particularly of the technologies that they regard as reflecting or useful for so-called civil-military fusion. Talk about these pieces of legislation, Gordon, their importance as you see them, and the criticism that Pete leveled that, you know, we shouldn't be emulating the Chinese Communist Party, picking winners and losers and so on in the process of trying to best them in these vital competitive arenas.
The whole issue is industrial policy. And yes, the U.S. government should not pick winners and losers, but we do need to fund technology, something that has not occurred for quite some time. And this is a failure on the part of both Republicans and Democrats. What we need to do is put a lot more federal money into research and development. That's how we got to the moon. That's how we built the interstate system. That's how we built the internet. All of these things had a government source. And although we all believe in free enterprise, and ultimately that's what drives our economy, nonetheless, there are times in history when the federal government does have to step in and start dumping a lot of money into our universities, our research labs, our even our private companies to do the R&D that is necessary to keep up. A decade ago, China was not considered a tech competitor. Now it is ahead in crucial areas. This was because of a firm Chinese commitment and determination to develop the technologies of tomorrow. We have not had that determination. If we're going to get to the moon, if we're going to get to the Mars, we're going to need much more of federal commitment to do this than we have at present. And so, yes, industrial policy is generally not a good thing, but this is a critical moment because we could lose our country, which means we do need to start to pay attention to this. And therefore, I think these bills in general are a good idea, even if some of the details are not the way they should be.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that, I think, in the days to come, as hopefully those details can be gotten right. Perhaps some of the things that are in the bills that shouldn't be are excised. Gordon, let me ask you about the prospect, based on what we've seen in recent days of Joe Biden's performance with Vladimir Putin at the summit, as they say, that we might have a summit in the near future between him and Xi Jinping, the communist despot, and, you know, it seems the unchallenged leader of China. First of all, is that correct that he is unchallenged? And second of all, what would you expect would be the upshot of such a meeting?
Yeah, I don't think Xi Jinping is unchallenged. And that's a whole big conversation. But we've got to remember that Xi Jinping, in climbing to the top, has made many enemies. And some of those enemies still have position and power in the Chinese system. And they're just waiting to pounce. And indeed, you know, Frank, China's foreign policy in the communist era has really been a reflection of domestic politics. So when Chinese external policies become more belligerent, as we see with the wolf warrior diplomats, as they're called, that's really a reflection of internal problems at the top of the Communist Party. You know, with regard to a proposed summit with Xi Jinping, again, here we have the Biden administration chasing the Chinese for dialogue. That's absolutely wrong. Even if you think that dialogue can advance our interests, And that's a big question. But even if you think so, you're not going to get the type of the dialogue you want if you're seen as being the needy party. And the Biden administration has done that, especially with those public comments from Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor of a couple of weeks ago, which made it clear that it was Washington that wanted this conversation between the two presidents. So I think that essentially we have got to say, look, yeah, we'll talk, but you got to come and talk to us. You've got to initiate it. You've got to come to our soil. And by the way, we may not even say yes, even if you ask. So those types of things, those types of messages need to be communicated to China. Because right now, we've said everything we need to say to China. We've said it over the course of many administrations. We know what the Chinese leadership thinks. So what's the point of talking? So that's the bigger issue.
Gordon, we have just about a minute and a half left. Very quickly, we talked, I think, the last time we visited about this fellow Dong Jingwei, who is reportedly now in the United States, having defected from a top position in China's Ministry of State Security. We talked again about this a bit with Pete, but I'd be very interested in your perspective on this. What's your current take on whether he's actually here, and if he is, what he's telling us?
Well, Beijing released a photo of him in China. So until we can learn that that photo was doctored, which I don't think it was, we don't have him. That doesn't mean we never had him. Some people have been saying that we actually returned him. I don't know, Frank, but the point is that he's not the only rumored defector. And when you have these rumors of defections, even if they aren't true, they are indications of problems at the top of the Chinese political system, because it means people are trying to destabilize the regime with false statements. So right now, he's not the only person who's been the subject of defector rumors, which means we know there's trouble in Beijing.
And trouble in Beijing can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how it's going to play itself out. And again, this is one of those things that we value so much your insights into, Gordon G. Chang at Twitter, as well as on this program and through your other appearances. You render an incalculably important service, and we're very grateful that you do it with us each week. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again next week, if you would, Gordon. In the meantime, safe travels. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis. We'll talk with him about the enemy within and the latest developments on unbelievable, violent actions in the northwest of the United States and what they might mean for all of us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's always a pleasure to say we are joined by one of our favorite regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, and that is Charles Sam Faddis. He has served with great distinction our country in a variety of capacities, including in the uniform of the United States Army and out of uniform, in fact, undercover for the Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine services. Among other things, before he finished his tour of duty with the agency, he was the director of its Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit, which is obviously something we better be focused on big time. He is also, I'm very pleased to say, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, incredibly productive contributor to our public policy debates, both through his books, notably his nonfiction work, Beyond Repair, The Fall and Decline of the Central Intelligence Agency, and not least, his excellent online resource and magazine.com. Sam Faddis, good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
A lot to talk with you about. You have done a three-part series at End Magazine that I'd like to get an update from you on. It talks about these radical and increasingly dangerous, well, violent extremists, I think would be the term for it, though it's not likely to be applied by the Biden administration for reasons we'll talk about in a moment, that have used sort of eco considerations, environmental concerns to serve as a pretext for their particular piece of the revolution against the United States, and a potentially very, very deadly one at that. You talked with us the last time you were on the show, I think, about this near miss using a mile-long train bomb, as I think you called it, to take out a refinery on the West Coast. And I'd like you to tell us what you think might come next, given the magnitude of that incredible undertaking and what it almost accomplished.
Right. Well, I think what people need to understand is that what we have now are what I call these bomb trains, which are typically a mile long, 100 plus cars that are carrying Bakken crude oil. Part of this is because people like Joe Biden are preventing the construction of pipelines. So we transport this stuff in the most dangerous way we could rather than safely via pipelines. And Bakken crude is a very volatile substance. It doesn't react like normal crude oil. It reacts more like gasoline. So these literally are bomb trains. And we have anarchists in the Northwest, but this has also happened up in Canada and other locations, targeting these rail lines with the specific goal of derailing them and therefore causing massive explosions. A few years ago, there was a relatively small town in Canada that was literally blown off the map by a derailment. So, and also keep in mind that these trains run through the hearts of major cities. They don't just run out, only in open prairie. So there's a lot of potential here for massive destruction. No indication the folks that are doing this are backing off. And in fact, ideologically, the ideology is becoming more extreme all the time. This is occurring against a backdrop of rhetoric that says we need to depopulate the planet and return to the wild. So these folks are explicitly dedicated to the destruction of modern society. That's the mindset that's behind this.
This is terrifying, needless to say. And as you indicated, it's the more so because we are looking at the growing probability of something like this happening, given the insistence of the Biden team on our using rails, at least until they phase them out too, for the transport of these fossil fuels, specifically the Bakken fuels. Sam, let me turn to another topic that I discussed a little bit with our colleague Pete Hoekstra, former congressman and chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. I'd like to get your perspective as a former member of that community about what Tucker Carlson is charging is being done to him personally by one of our most sensitive elements of that community, namely the National Security Agency. What do you make of the prospect that he claims the powers of the NSA have been employed to obtain without his permission, heavens knows, and probably without any kind of court order, the contents of emails and other telecommunications that he has generated?
Well, I mean, up front, let me say this. I have been following it closely and have looked into all the facts, and I suspect that Tucker is exactly right and that this collection is occurring. And as you said, it's occurring extra legally. In other words, nobody's got a warrant on Tucker Carlson. There's no FISA court ruling. There are a bunch of loopholes here that have been exploited. One of them is so-called incidental collection. Theoretically, we're looking at another target and we just picked up your communications in the process. In that kind of case, there's supposed to be all sorts of procedures that keep them from retaining that information and keep them from disseminating that information.
Abusing
and,
it, particularly.
Like all those, yeah. I mean, if it's picked up and it's incidental, essentially, it should not be retained in the system, and it definitely shouldn't be disseminated, and we shouldn't focus on it. It sounds to me like we are ignoring that. And unfortunately, these days, what we see with the intelligence community and law enforcement, I find that entirely plausible. I have no trouble believing that that is occurring.
Sam, what's most alarming to me about all of this is that there seems to be not only a concern about this particular agency doing this particular wrongdoing, but that there are more generally efforts being made by the Biden administration to weaponize the rest of the intelligence community, and for that matter, the FBI and the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice, perhaps among others, in their kind of political warfare against our countrymen and women, simply because they voted for Donald Trump or they have expressed sentiments that seem to be athwart the views, the positions, the policy preferences of the Biden team. Talk a little bit about how real that prospect is and why what Tucker's worried about, understandably, is bad enough, but that it may well be the very tippy top of the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, well, you know, as crazy as all of this would have once sounded, it is now reality. I don't think it is. This is precisely where we are. If you look at the national strategy on countering domestic extremism that the Biden administration trotted out, weeks ago, it is laying the groundwork for the justification for using the intelligence and law enforcement apparatus of the United States against political opponents of this regime. So it's something straight out of what we would have once derided as a third world country. That is precisely where we are. The FBI doesn't have time to find the guys derailing trains or burning cities, but they will throw out a dragnet to track down people all over this country who they are literally charging with nothing more than trespass in the Capitol on 6 January. They are literally charging people, deploying massive resources to find folks to charge them with misdemeanor offenses of trespass, unlawful entry, but they can't focus on folks burning Portland, Minneapolis, and so forth. In fact, they pretend like it doesn't exist. I think we have personally reached a point where individual law enforcement and intelligence officers are going to need to make some really hard ethical decisions. I think if you're an FBI special agent, we are at the point where you're going to have to stand up and say, I swore an oath to the Constitution, not to Joe Biden. And no, I will not go execute your warrant on this. And no, I will not drop this investigation of this leftist anarchist organization. I think that's where we are. Every person working in this whole edifice needs to look in the mirror and make a judgment about what they're about and why they got into this in the first place.
I couldn't agree more, Sam. And as somebody who has, you know, walked the walk yourself, I know that you're speaking that in the most heartfelt way. And, you know, I'm like, I think many of our countrymen and women, quite convinced that the vast majority of people doing the kinds of jobs you once did, doing the kinds of jobs that are now required as, you know, a special agent in the FBI or as an analyst or collector at the National Security Agency and so on. These are good, public-spirited, patriotic Americans. I certainly pray that's the case and believe it to be so. But this is a time, as you say, of testing. We need to know whether they are or not. And Sam, this brings me to another point. You have been contributing to an important initiative. It's called the Accountability Initiative, and people can find its products at accountabilityinitiative.org. There is a new report there about a counterintelligence problem of really the first order, which again speaks to this question of, are our intelligence agencies, particularly those charged with counterintelligence, doing their jobs? And it deals with a group of people, several mentioned in this article that we ought to talk a little bit about, who are representatives in the House of Representatives, members of Congress, and that seem to be serious counterintelligence threats to our security. One, if you can believe it, a member of the House Intelligence Committee itself. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. Well, I mean, of course, we're talking about Eric Swalwell, but more broadly, we're talking about, you know, a whole cast of characters coming out of California in particular. I mean, the Chinese have for a long time been specifically targeting politicians and focusing, this may surprise people, but on the state level. And that makes a lot of sense, frankly, because first of all, California is an important state, but also because people who you recruit at the state level have a tendency to then run for federal office. And it is much easier to recruit people early on in their careers when they need money and they need support. And then, you know, as the Russians did years ago in Britain to great effect, you just retain them over the course of decades as they rise up through the power structure. This has been ongoing for a really long time. And as you suggested, we're doing effectively nothing from a counterintelligence perspective to do anything to stop it. And in the case of Swalwell, who's a classic example, even when it finally does come to light that, look, this guy was suborned by Chinese intelligence, there's no consequence. I mean, he retains his seat. He retains his access. As far as we know, he could be meeting a Chinese intelligence handler every couple of weeks and passing him everything he has, and we're not doing anything to of any consequence. So we're letting them run rampant, and we're likely paying a massive price for it.
Just a fine point on this, Sam, as a former handler of spies working for our country, that point you just made is extremely telling, is it not? That it would be part and parcel of the tradecraft of running agents that have been recruited, in this case, for the Chinese Communist Party, for an ongoing relationship to be maintained with a handler, albeit on a more circumspect basis, presumably, than sleeping with the enemy agent who recruited him. Talk a little bit about that, just because it does, as I say, really raise to a very important point the idea that this guy must no longer have access to the most sensitive information in our government, which is what members of the House Intelligence Committee generally do have access to.
Sure. Well, I mean, in the business of human intelligence and espionage, what the term of art would be develop. You develop a guy, you wine him, you dine him, or whatever else he's into, you pull him over the line.
Sexual favors, for example, in this case.
In the case of Fang Fang or whatever her name was, whatever it is that is is the key that unlock him. And then once he is fully recruited, another term of art, and agrees to become an agent of your government, you do not continue that open social relationship. You move it to fully clandestine handling. That's dead drops or meeting in a car in the middle of the night or meeting in a safe house or whatever is appropriate. But the whole point is that contact becomes invisible as a matter of the tradecraft that is used. So the fact that Swalwell does not currently walk around on the social circuit with a Chinese, a young Chinese woman, doesn't tell us anything. In fact, it would be entirely consistent with the fact that he became a fully recruited asset and all contact is now clandestine and below the radar. That's how spies work. So yes, he could be a fully recruited asset passing intelligence to Chinese right now.
And the question is, has anybody actually investigated that possibility, let alone precluded it from being a very serious threat to the national security? And I'm fearful that the answer is no, and that it's business as usual as far as Nancy Pelosi is concerned, because she too has problems with compromising by the Chinese Communist Party. And I believe that will be a topic for a future edition of this very important accountability initiative project. And I commend you and others who are involved in it, Sam, for your work there. Let me just conclude, because we are, of course, at the eve of our national holiday, the 4th of July. I don't think we'll talk again beforehand, and I just want to thank you for an important tribute to the idea of unity, e pluribus unum, of our country. It's central character, really, that you feature at End Magazine this week, and just give you a concluding word on that if you want to take.
Well, I think that's where we are, right? It is time for us to come together. The forces that threaten this republic are focused on division. They're focused on driving us apart. It is a deliberate tactic. It weakens us. It allows them to do what they want to do. And so, you know, obviously the antidote to that, the counter to that, is to remember that the most important thing is we are all Americans, and not let them do this. Stop letting this divide us and turn us against each other.
Sam Faddis, God bless you for all you do for our country and have done over your many years of distinguished service. Thank you most especially for being one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll look forward to talking with you on the other side of the 4th of July holiday, and a blessed one to you and your family. And to the rest of you as well, I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for the same time, same station featuring of this program.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.